Sean Hughes on FUBAR Radio.
Naughty boys in nasty schools, headmasters breaking all the rules, having fun and playing fools, smashing up the woodwork tools. All the teachers in the pub, passing round the ready rub, trying not to think of when the lunchtime bell will ring again. Oh, what fun we had, but did it really turn out bad? All I learnt at school was how to bend, not break the rule. Oh, what fun we had, but at the time it seems so bad, trying different ways to make a difference through. The headmaster's had enough today, all the kids have gone away, gone to fight with next door school. Every turn that is the rule, sits alone and bends his cane, same old backsides again. All the small ones tell two tales, walking home and squashing snails. Oh, what fun we had, but did it really turn out bad? All I learnt at school was how to bend, not break the rule. Oh, what fun we had, but at that time it seemed so bad, trying different ways to make the difference. Noise, playing football in the park, kicking bush bikes after dark. Baggy trousers, dirty shirt, pulling hair and eating dirt. Teacher comes to breaking up, back of the end with a plastic cup. Oh, what fun we had, but did it really turn out bad? All I learned at school was how to bend, not break the rule. Oh, what fun we had, but at that time it seemed so bad, trying different ways to make the difference.
I think that's called Baggy Trousers. Madness. Here we are, FUBAR. I'm Sean Hughes. Thanks for listening. Cracking show today. The stupendous Nick Helms, the first guest. Then we got Pete Bennett from Big Brother on. And another great comic, Nish Kumura. And then some live music from Orlando Seal. And then Little Ben, our philosophy teacher. Well, you know, student, but he's my teacher. So we'll play a little track, and I'm going to talk to the lovely Nick Helm for as long as he wants. This is Barefoot in the Park by Cinerama.
That smile on your face as you makes my heart ache. Let's lie all day here in the dark. Watch barefoot in the park. And it's because you're so sublime that I think about you. It's true, 'cause how could anybody not love you? When you open my lips with your thumb, so divine. You're every single dream I've had come true. I'm so glad I found you. Yes, it's because you're just sublime. It's true, 'cause how could anybody not love you? And the world before I met you, I can't remember now, what was that like? 'Cause you, you're so beautiful, there is no part of you that I dislike. Oh, what would I do?
That's Cinerama there, Barefoot in the Park. Now, Nick Helm is in. Now, I've known Nick quite a while. You probably know him best from Sunday Brunch. No, Uncle was just finished. No, we were talking about Nick was on that recently, and it's not a very pleasant experience, but we won't talk about it. Well, like, Uncle. Uncle is... totally my favourite comedy this year on telly. Well done.
Oh, thank you, thank you.
Because, like, did you know you were a good actor?
No, no.
No, because you really, like, I thought you really surprised me because I thought your acting was brilliant in it.
Yeah. Well, before we filmed it, I read the Michael Caine book on acting.
What,
on
don't blink? Is
on
it?
Screen. It basically, don't blink and have your hands by your side. Try and do as little as possible. I bought it on, because I got put it on DVD as well.
Right.
I found it on Amazon.
Okay.
And there's...
What, like, what, so there's a DVD of him saying...
It was the BBC special. It was right. Michael Caine talking to actors. There's like four actors in front of a larger audience, and one of them, Celia Imrie. And they all, like, put their hands up and ask him questions, and he gives them acting tips.
So they're the two things you took from him, don't blink and keep your hands by your side.
Well, no, I'd done, like, a couple of short films, and the thing that really always irritated me was how loud and busy I was. And so when I watched the Michael Caine thing, I was just like, oh, yeah, just don't do anything. So I tried to do as little as possible.
Well, I guess there was definitely a kind of... There was a bit of a stance about it. See, the thing which I found... Weirdly, I think a lot of people think that. It feels like you wrote it, because it feels like...
Yeah.
It's not a million miles away from what your stage stuff is like.
Yeah.
But you had no hand in the writing, no?
No, I didn't. I didn't write it. They'd written the pilot before I came on board. Oliver Refson had written the pilot, and he'd sent it to Baby Cow, and Henry Norman had read it, and I'd just worked with Baby Cow, and Henry said that I'd be good for it. But when I came in, it was originally about an out-of-work actor.
Right.
And then they kind of repositioned it so that I could write songs for it. I didn't ask to. Henry said that he can write songs. So why don't you rewrite it so he's a musician, so that you can use that if you wanted to?
Well, yeah, because obviously it works so much better with the kind of music in it. Like,
I think that if it's an actor, it's slightly more navel gazing than it, but like you can have a bit more fun with.
But it's different because the songs are part of the story as well.
Yeah, well, they weren't any songs in it originally.
Yeah,
but then we did the pilot over on Channel 4, and then a year later we did. We reshot the pilot.
I know, that must have been a bit weird as well.
Yeah. No, that was mental.
Yeah.
Because I thought that we dodged a bullet with the pilot. Like, you know, you did it, but you went like, well, you know, I just about got away with that.
So what, you think you got better as the series went on then?
I learned to act during the... Well, I learned to
Thanks
act.
To Michael.
Thanks to Michael Caine. Well, that was it. When we got the series, I thought, well, I better take this seriously. So I found the DVD.
What's the next DVD you're going to get to
I don't
help?
Know. I don't know.
For the second series, who are you going to take your inspiration from?
Oh, I don't know.
Patrick Stewart?
No, probably not. Probably not.
You don't? Not a fan?
I'm trying to imagine the... No, Peter O'Toole, I don't know, he drinks.
He's dead, though.
Yeah, but you don't have to be alive to have recorded something in the 80s.
Yeah, but I don't think he did. I don't think he ever got it together enough to do People are coming in here. What's happening? Right. They're ringing on the door and slapping their hand just to move the mic a tiny fraction away. And you know what I'm going to do now? Move a little bit lower. No. But now also you have... how many Edinburghs have you done?
I've done in the region of every Edinburgh since 1997.
And so the first one was what, a full show?
I didn't write the first Edinburgh I did. That was written by a little man called Shakespeare. little man that I like to call William Shakespeare. My first Edinburgh was in 97 and it was like a school play. But my first thing that I wrote was 2001.
So did you want to be an actor initially then?
I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I wanted to do something artistic.
Right.
I knew that. I used to draw, and I used to write music, and I used to act, and I used to write, and all this other stuff. But I didn't really know how that would translate into a job.
So were you thinking at one point of maybe becoming a musician, just pure and simple?
I didn't know. I honestly didn't have a clue what to do, what I was meant to do. I was doing data entry, you know. I was doing data entry, and I was absolutely, you know.
What kind of data did you come up with?
I didn't come up with the data.
Yeah, but what?
I was handed the data. Well, basically what it was, I was working in Hatfield, and we would get, you'd have like a serial number, some bank details, an address, and a phone number, and you'd fill that in.
Right. Yeah? It sounds like fraud.
You'd fill each bit in, right?
Yeah.
And then that would be that. Then you'd put that piece of paper onto that side, you're done,
yeah.
And then you'd do it again. And it was like, it was basically a 3-minute job that you repeated until you killed yourself.
Why did you want to leave that job?
What I did was I wrote a musical at the same time.
Right.
So I was at my desk and I'd be kind of like writing.
And what happened to the musical? Was it about data?
I didn't know. I did it. It was called I Think You Stink. I did it in 2008.
Well, so you see... So
but when
so
I was
much.
Writing it, I was thinking it's great being paid to write. And
yeah.
But I was just doing it at my desk in between.
But so Uncle's coming back for a second series. And
yeah.
Well, like, because it had every element that I liked. The kid's brilliant in it as well.
Yeah.
And you seem to have three girlfriends in it.
Yeah.
So which was your favourite?
But that's not gentlemanly, is it?
No, but what is it called, Gentleman FM? No, that is unfair, actually. But which one was?
My sister was my favourite.
Right. Well, that's very. But what we're going to do is we're going to play one of your tracks now. Let's Get Married. Is this on the new album?
That's on the current album. Yeah.
So you've got three albums.
I've got two live albums at the moment, and I've got a studio. This is off my studio album that I did.
And so, with the songs, like, are they all comedy songs?
There's songs.
Yeah. And they're great tunes.
I think there's songs that are funny as opposed to all out comedy songs. Some of them aren't so funny. I did a song called No Survivors on the TV series,
yeah.
And that's just slightly exaggerated, you know. But it's not really a comedy song. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of like it's a slightly exaggerated. So I don't know. I don't really like the term comedy song, I suppose.
Yeah, I agree with you, but listen, this is Let's Get Married.
This is a comedy song.
Okay.
Let's get married in the springtime, in the sunshine. Let's get married, let's get married in the daylight, when the time's right. Let's get married. You can wear your hair up like a halo around your head. I can say I love you till the day that I am dead. Let's get married in the sunshine. Let's get married. Oh. Let's get naked in the nighttime when you feel fine. Let's get naked. Let's get naked. Take our clothes off. And my socks off, let's get naked. I can say you're beautiful and that you are the one. You can say you don't like anything I've ever done. Let's get naked in the nighttime. Let's get naked. Oh, let's have babies when the time's right. When we're settled, let's have babies. Let's have babies. Oh, you're pregnant.
romantic song there from Nick Helm. See, because the thing as well, like when I kind of first met you, you were having that tremendous Edinburgh, but it was because you were very heartbroken at the time.
2011.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just, well, I wasn't really at the time.
But
the year before I was.
Yeah, but you kind of became known as the heartbroken guy a little bit, though, didn't you?
Yeah, I think that's good, though.
Yeah, absolutely. But then you're all of a sudden happy the following year and you kind of have to change your kind of tone a little bit.
It's quite difficult. It is a difficult thing. Yeah, you've got to kind of roll with it.
And so with the music as well, obviously Michael Caine was the big for the acting. What DVD did you listen to for the music? Inspiration?
No, nothing really. I worked a lot with David Trent, and so we were listening to lots of, for that song.
Right.
Listening to sort of like what the Specials and stuff like that.
So what were the bands that you liked when you were growing up then?
It's weird actually. I've just watched a documentary. I'm watching lots of. I'm going to do some live music stuff.
Right.
So I'm watching lots of concerts. And also I'm writing a TV show.
Yeah. Tell us about the TV show though.
Well, so I did sort of a pilot last year, which wasn't technically a pilot, called Heavy Entertainment. And they gave me. They had they gave me 5 weeks to make a pilot from scratch.
And with no word written?
Yeah.
Right.
So basically I went in and I'd done a Radio Christmas show for them on Radio 1, and that had gone down well. And I enjoyed doing that.
See, I didn't hear that because I'm 48.
It was Boxing Day. It was on Boxing Day. Yeah, it was a bit of a... Everyone was like saying, oh, you're doing a thing for 16-year-olds, and I didn't really have any concept of that.
I thought it was 14-year-olds for Radio 1.
I've no idea. I don't know who listened to it. But I know that I was the first person to do a radio comedy special since Chris Morris.
All right, now stop bigging yourself up.
That was amazing. And so I really enjoyed that. But I'd just done a series called Live at the Electric on Series 1, and I had a bit of a difficult time... We were on last every night when we recorded it, and the audience would get up and leave whenever we came up on stage.
But surely that's not the way that's supposed to happen.
Well, they edited it really cleverly, so it looked like the audience were attentive, but in actual fact, they were piling out because they were trying to get the last tune.
Well, so they pretty much said, what did the floor manager go, that's the end of the show, there's band playing on the way out?
They would do, they would be like, I think it was, they were long records. They started about 7:30 and they'd go on until about 10.
Oh.
And then they'd stop, and then they'd put the band out, and then I'd come on and I'd do like two or three songs.
But every recording, like some of the Buzzcocks we did, took 3 hours.
Yeah.
For a half hour,
yeah.
Kind of.
Well, there was like 3.5 hours, and then we'd come out, and then at that point everyone was like, and then we don't know who this guy is.
And did they give the audience to ply them with booze?
No, I don't think that was it. I can't remember. But basically, I'd just done that, and I was like, oh, I'm not really sure about live telly. Not like live telly, but TV in front of a live audience. So I didn't initially want to do the pilot.
So what's the the new show, like, what's the plan for that then?
Currently, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to translate what I do on stage into a half-hour, six-part series.
But not in front of a live audience, though?
Yeah.
Even though you don't like playing to TV live audiences?
Well, we did this pilot, like, which wasn't technically a pilot. I had 5 weeks before the tax year.
So what should we call it?
Called Heavy Entertainment.
No, what should we call it? Because we're saying it's not a pilot, so we have to give it a different word.
It was a taster.
I think
was the thing. It was a taster. But there was no real intention to do a series out of it. I tried to treat it like it was a one-off special. And then they said, oh, you've got a series. And I was like,
woohoo!
What am I meant to do with that?
That's not the reaction. You're supposed to go woohoo.
Well, I mean, I have a daily struggle with it. Some days I wake up and I think this is great, I can do this, and some days I wake up and I go, this is a fucking nightmare.
Have you got anyone helping you though?
I have people helping me. Some people helping me, but I have difficulty. No one can really write for me because. I've got to do it myself, really.
Right. Yeah, which I think that's the best way, obviously.
So I am working with people, but really they're sounding boards.
Right.
Which is kind of, must be incredibly fulfilling for them.
No, because your Edinburgh shows are always fairly organic as well, isn't it? You come up with the main idea and then...
Yeah, I sort of come up with the concept and then I try and make everything about that concept. I think that works. It's worked in the past, and it's kind of like a good way. Because basically, the way Edinburgh works is that you've got to come up with a title and a blurb for a show that you haven't written.
I know, yeah.
So you come up with the best title or the best blurb that you can because you want to sell tickets, and then you spend the next 6 months panicking because you haven't got a show.
What was your last show called?
My last show is called One Man Megamyth.
Right, which I saw and I loved, but particularly the outfits.
Yeah, but that was the kind of thing where I wasn't, in my head, I definitely wasn't doing Edinburgh. I'd done This Means War the year before, and I definitely wasn't going to do Edinburgh. I was definitely having a year off. And then my producer basically said, you can't really afford to take a year off this year. And then that was like end of January, early February. So it was really late. And then all of a sudden it's just like, oh, I guess I'm doing Edinburgh. So I had to come up with a concept and a thing. I had a Evel Knievel jacket lying around. Had a title.
You happen to have an Evel Knievel?
Because I used it for a show that I wrote in 2007, I think.
I loved Evel Knievel.
So, well, good. He was a, yeah.
Oh,
he was an inspiration. Did you see that documentary that he did with David Hammond?
I think you're the only one watching all these documentaries.
That was it was really interesting. Everyone was like, oh God. Evel Knievel's a bit cagey, isn't he? Oh, Evel Knievel's a bit of an arsehole. Oh, David Hammond went over to interview Evel Knievel, and he was so rude to him. And then it turns out he had a stroke the day before they started filming. Well, and it's just like,
did anyone know? Or
they said he's got some health problems, and it kind of emerged. But like, it's just like, oh, people have chosen to ignore that. But everyone's, the big thing about that documentary was just like, Evel Knievel, what a dick. He was so rude to poor David Hammond. Just like, they stuck a fucking camera in his face like 12 hours after he had a fucking stroke.
To be fair, he could have said, I'm not doing the documentary, I just had a stroke. You know, that could have been a way out.
He needed it, Sean.
But is he still around now, is he? Or is he?
Evel Knievel?
Yeah.
No, he died. He had a stroke.
Because of that?
He had a stroke, the day before they filmed the documentary, and then he died about 7 months later.
Of?
Being Evel Knievel.
Well, yeah,
but what was awful about it was Evel Knievel was just like, just absolutely physically fucked.
Well, and yeah,
he had a friend that was that used to be like his bodyguard, that was like 2 years younger than him, who was also in the documentary, who was still doing stunts. He was just like a physical specimen of, you know, perfection.
Because I remember, like, as a child, which probably before your time, but didn't he? I think he came over to Wembley. Mm-hmm. You know, and was Wembley packed?
I did that in my show.
Yes, yeah.
I talked a bit about that in my show. Which was, Wembley, no, they hadn't sold any tickets because nobody knew who Evel Knievel was. So he came over to Wembley and then he was going to jump, he jumped 13 double-decker buses.
Right.
And, or rather he didn't. And what he did in the build-up to the Wembley gig was he just went on stuff like Blue Peter. And literally, he sold it out by doing kind of like kids' telly.
Right.
And then...
like 70,000 people?
Yeah, it was packed. But no one literally.
Note to self: get on Blue Peter.
They hadn't sold.
Sell that tour.
They hadn't sold any tickets, and then hardly any tickets. And then he came along and he did it, and then he jumped over 13 double decker buses. But he didn't. He crashed, and he went in like a coma for days. And everyone thought he was going to die. And
did he crash into what, the 13th one?
He didn't quite make the jump, and then, or maybe he mislanded. He probably made it,
right,
and then mislanded. But he basically, there's footage of him, and he's literally, you can just see him breaking every single bone in his body.
Because back in that day, there wouldn't have been big screens for people to watch, would there?
No, this is what I said. This is what I said in my show. Yeah.
So it's just like people going, what, is that him?
Well,
there?
That's the thing. He used to come out. I mean, this is how he was kind of such. He was morally dubious, right? Because what he'd do was he'd come out. He was an alcoholic. He cheated on his wife. You know, he kind of wasn't around for his kids. And the thing that got him up in the morning was potentially killing himself. You know, leaving them with nothing, right? But he was a pioneer. He kind of invented kind of.
I didn't realise he was an alcoholic.
Yeah, he had alcohol in his
cane. He would have been like well sourced up doing the stunts.
He would have. He'd definitely be hungover and stuff like that. And I would imagine he was addicted to painkillers, but, I mean, that's just a bit of a thing. But what would happen is he'd come out and he'd do, like, this big speech to everyone. Have you ever seen...
I love you like a brother!
But have you seen Viva Knievel?
Yeah, yeah.
That's an amazing film, yeah. Right? And so he comes out and he does these inspirational speeches about how, you know, you shouldn't do drugs and you should, you know, live your dreams and stuff like that. And then he'd jump over the thing. And then they said, you know... You're so inspirational. Where'd you get it from? He goes, well, the jump lasts 3 seconds. So you've got to say something to pad out the... Yeah, it's like you've sold out Wembley. You sold out Wembley Stadium.
Did they have support acts? Like people doing six buses? And...
I don't know. Well, I think they used to have like rodeo clowns and stuff like that.
That's what's missing in life.
But there was no big screens, like you say, right? I took the piss in my show, like saying they had a juggler. I don't know if they had a juggler. But like you can imagine everyone turning up to Wembley Stadium with no big screens to watch a tiny little man on a bike crash.
But I kind of... Now that you tell me about the alcoholism, wouldn't it have been really funny that after every jump they breathalyse them? Listen, we'll play a tune and then we'll talk a little bit more. What song shall we play? I think we'll go for The Strokes.
Don't give a fuck. I wanna steal your innocence. Show me my love and don't make it sense. 'Cause
right, yeah, stop it, guys. Yeah, the song's over. There's no need for that. And the council, you don't do that at the end of your songs, do you? Just messy bit at the end?
No, I'd like a nice, tight ending.
Nice, clean ending. So, now, have you been offered any acting work since Uncle as well? Have you been going up for stuff?
I've been offered... went for one audition for the 24 movie.
Okay.
For a
data analyst?
Yeah, it was a computer hacker. And I did the audition. It was meant to be like this really high stakes, kind of intense scene. And I did the audition and they said, are you from the West Country? And I was like, no, I was born in Finsbury Park. And they were like, oh, do it again then, doesn't matter. And it's just like, right, well, you're not going to hire someone going, Mr. President, I would, you know, it's
we're in trouble, Mr. President.
We're in trouble, Mr. President. I've been doing some hacking, so no, I didn't get that. And then the other two things I've got are for like mid-30s slacker slobby guys.
Well, you will see. People don't think outside the box.
It's like, wow, I was at. You know what I mean? It's just like, oh yeah. Do you know what I'd like to do? I'd like to do the exact same part that I've just done.
But that's what happens all the time. Like, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But and so also because this was like your biggest exposure. Like, you know, you've been working away and building up your audiences.
Yeah.
So did you enjoy all the things that went with that? All the publicity you had to do.
I like interviews. I mean, I like doing. I like radio interviews specifically. They're nice. This is really
yeah. But
fun.
I'm talking about, you know, where they look. People probably don't seem to realise, but they just give you a 2-page list and go, "This is the people you're talking to today." And some of them just.
It wasn't really that bad. My PR lady's like really good, and we're like friends.
Yeah,
and she's kind of
so she knows on me. Not to put you on stuff.
We're learning because, you know, you've got to learn together, haven't you? But I mean,
it sounds like it could be a song, Nick.
About learn me and my PR lady learning what I will and won't do.
And yeah. With the second series of Uncle, will you have more of a hand in the writing?
It was weird because I was actually offered the chance to have more input in the writing, but when the script came in, it was really just a case of like, I don't honestly know what I would.
But did you not do any improvisation or anything?
Yeah, I mean, there's a certain, especially with the pilot. I mean, what happened with the pilot was I improvised quite a lot around the pilot, and then when we got the scripts again, a lot of my lines were incorporated into the episode one. We had to expand episode one.
Right.
But that's the thing, you know. He hadn't met me when he wrote the pilot, and then when he wrote the series, he wrote the series with me in mind,
sure,
specifically.
Yeah.
So it was. So the pilot wasn't written for me, but the series.
Well,
was.
So initially it was just an audition, then.
No, I didn't audition. I'm rubbish at auditioning, so I didn't audition. Henry Normal literally just worked with me, and he said Nick would be good for this, and he knew that I could do
well,
it.
Well, yeah, that was a good call.
And the thing about Oliver is he'd never done any TV before. He'd done some short films. So Oliver hadn't done anything, and I hadn't done anything. So Henry really just took a big leap of faith.
So, because why did Channel 4 not pick up on it anyway?
I think it was, there was a four funny season with right. Doc Brown, Rubber Bandits, I always forget.
Then
there's another one.
Go, yeah.
But there was like the four. One. There was four of us, right? I was Gittins, Brian Gittins,
right?
And there was so, and none of them got picked up. And I think that's because Shane was with Channel 4. Shane Allen was with Channel 4, and then he left Channel 4, went up to BBC. And I think it was more a case of out with the old, in with the new.
And so then he decided, he remembered it and said, "I'll take it to the BBC." Because that doesn't happen very often.
I don't think. Well, it's actually it doesn't happen really.
No.
Sometimes series gets dropped. You know, like Men Behaving Badly was on ITV and then that got dropped and then BBC took that. But, I mean, it doesn't really happen that.
Does Michael Caine talk about any of that stuff at all?
I think originally, yeah, Jaws the Revenge was dropped by Columbia and then it was picked up by Universal.
Well, I think The Swarm was probably his best bit of acting, though, wasn't it?
What's great is they go, they say, you know, Michael Caine is like, have you ever seen Jaws the Revenge? And he goes, no, I've heard it's a terrible movie, but the house it bought is beautiful.
Yes, I don't like when people say stuff like that, though, because, you know, it just makes
it... Yeah, it is a that's a lack of respect for me, mate.
Yeah,
you know
what? Yeah.
I like the first Jaws film. I like the second Jaws film. Did not like the third Jaws film.
And
I thought Jaws the Revenge was going to bring it back.
How do you feel about the Rockies?
The Rocky movies,
yeah,
they're all good in their own way.
Yeah, but the first one was phenomenal.
The first one's phenomenal. I think the sixth one is phenomenal. I just went to see Sylvester Stallone interviewed by Jonathan Ross at the London Palladium.
They're doing a lot of that now, aren't they?
Yeah, it is weird.
And so was it a good night?
Well, they did Al Pacino last year, and then it was brilliant. It was brilliant. You get to see... You're like sat in the same room as Sylvester Stallone, and he's... I'm a huge Sylvester Stallone fan, and his films aren't... But it's the difference between Sylvester Stallone and Daniel Day-Lewis, and you go, yeah, Daniel Day-Lewis is without a doubt one of the greatest actors of any generation, but I wouldn't necessarily go and see... The Women, the one with the, or the, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like he makes films that you wouldn't go and see. He also makes films that you have to go and see, like There Will Be Blood, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But with Sylvester Stallone, it's not about each individual film. It's about the fact that he is a self-made man.
Well,
he's an Oscar-winning writer.
Yeah, exactly. People slag him off, but he did write Rocky. But I believe he wrote it in about a week or something as well.
He famously wrote the first draft in 4 days.
And so what was the most enthralling thing he said at the Palladium? Nick, I enjoyed Uncle.
No. I don't think it had been on for that long.
Was it a Q&A as well?
He'll have definitely been familiarised with it by now. But yeah, there was a Q&A, there was an audience Q&A, but basically Jonathan Ross came out and he just interviewed.
You didn't ask a question though?
No, I couldn't imagine what sort of people would go to this sort of thing. And the tickets were, like, really expensive. We managed to get cheap tickets right at the last minute.
You're doing all right. Why are you getting cheap tickets?
I'm not an idiot. I couldn't imagine what sort of, you know, who's going to the London Palladium to see Sylvester Stallone chat to Jonathan Ross. And they are much bigger fans than me. You know, I am a huge Sylvester Stallone fan, and these people are just... He came out, and people just were crying and shouting out, "We love you, Rock!" You know, it's just like... for a certain demographic of people, he's, like, completely...
But what,
he's
what
a
is
total
his
inspiration. I've no idea.
No, but who was that?
Because there's loads of things, isn't there? From a filmmaking point of view, he's an actor, he's a producer, he's a writer, he's a director.
Yeah.
Right? He directed Staying Alive, right?
I know.
Right? He's not in that.
Have you seen the porn film he did?
Party at Kitty and Studs. I haven't seen it. It's also renamed The Italian Stallion.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it. But I've deliberately left some Sylvester Stallone films that are unwatched so that there are still Sylvester Stallone films to watch in the future.
Actually, I do that thing of... I kind of tend to buy a lot of DVDs and then still I Sky Plus a lot of programmes, so I end up watching the rubbish ones, thinking I'm saving the good ones for... I don't know what.
What are you saving them for?
An illness.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not saving the good ones. I'm saving Fist.
Fist's all right, actually.
I haven't seen it. But I've got that to look forward to later on.
Do you own it?
Yeah.
So you have it?
I have it,
And when are you going to watch it?
I don't know.
Come on, let's make a decision.
No.
Let's make a decision right now.
I'll watch it in years to come.
In years to come?
I didn't see Grudge Man. But the thing is, from a filmmaking point of view, he's like inspirational. But also from like a physical point of view, there were women asking questions about physical fitness and stuff like that. And he can answer any of these things. He's an inspiration to lots of people in lots of different ways, in a way that Daniel Day-Lewis is good at acting.
Yeah.
You know? And so
what would you say, what was the most enlightening thing he said then?
I can't remember it. You weren't allowed to take glasses in, so I took a pint of wine in with me, and the whole night was a blur.
That seems a bit of a waste.
No, not really. It was brilliant.
And did you get an autograph afterwards?
No, I don't do that sort of thing.
Why? You've never had an autograph?
I got one autograph once off of William Shatner.
Right.
But I don't tend to. I don't tend to like that sort of thing.
And have you kept it though?
Yeah, it's in his book, so I had to.
Well, I thought you said you wrote about it. That there was a time I gave that Nick Helm an autograph. But listen, it's been absolutely a pleasure having you in. So for people, you're going to do the occasional live thing now, or are you going to do a tour?
It's quite difficult to tour because, I don't know what I'm doing, to be fair. What I want to do is I've had quite a break from doing club sets and stuff like that. I've had about a year off from doing club sets, so I'm just trying to get back into that.
You still like doing the clubs though, yeah?
No.
But that's what I mean, because your show.
But it's annoying when you realise you used to be good at it. I used to have a really good Club 20 and I was really proud of it. And it was like a proper good Club 20 where where it was a showstopper. You know, people would go, "That's good."
Yeah, I can be really hit and miss over 20 minutes, but 2 hours, I'm fine.
I got to a point where I was, well, that's the thing. You can, especially with an hour or 2 hours or something like that, people are specifically coming to see you at that point. In a club, it's a lucky dip, isn't it?
I know, but also you can't really expand on anything. You have to stick to fairly basic stuff.
Yeah. No, that's true. And you can certainly like explore specific things with it. I prefer hours. I'm more of an Edinburgh comedian than a club comedian, but it is annoying, kind of like...
Will you pop up and see anyone in Edinburgh, or are you just going to leave it well alone?
I'm doing... We haven't confirmed it yet, but I'm doing something in Edinburgh for a couple of days, and then I'm going to... go and see some stuff. It'll be interesting.
In particular, that show, Bum.
Yeah, that looks great.
Yeah, no, I'm going to get cheap tickets for that and a big carton of wine.
You don't need to get... It's on the Free Fringe. It's fine.
Yeah, but you pay.
Yeah, okay, but you're not getting cheap tickets. You could pay as much or as little as you like.
Well, I'll pay a little then.
Okay, but it is meant to be good.
Yeah, so that's your tip for the Edinburgh...
Bum.
Yeah, right. So just you heard it here first on... what's the name of the station?
FUBAR Radio.
I just need to be reminded every so often.
It's good.
So you heard it here. Bum is going to win the Perrier this year. It's Nick Helm's tip. Let's have another tune. Thank you so much for coming in, Nick. Pleasure as ever. Here's a Canadian band that you might not have heard of called The Organ.
Oh, they're great.
Thank you.
Radio, The Finger.
Yes, indeed. Now, I have another guest in, Pete Bennett. Thank you so much for coming in.
Yeah, hello.
How are you doing?
Nice to meet you, Sean.
So you were you had trouble getting here today as well?
Yeah, man, some cheeky bargain line. I mean, sorry, I'm literally just getting my breath.
Yeah, don't worry about it.
Yeah, some geezer jumped on the train tracks and made me late. You know,
is he all right, though?
Who cares? I'm late. I'm in.
All right, okay. So now,
sorry. No, I'm going to be nice. I apologise for that.
So you won Big Brother in 2006.
Oh, yes. Hello. Yeah, I did, yeah. So, sorry about that. Sorry about that, everyone. I didn't. It was an accident. I didn't.
What, winning Big Brother?
Yeah, I was kidnapped. I had no choice. No, that's a joke. I won it. Yes, I did win it. Yeah, I did it on purpose. I actually knew I was going to win, though. So it was. I had to pretend to be a bit surprised at the end. Like, wait, look at me.
But so is there any like what when they let you know that you're going to be on it? Do they hide you away for a bit then?
Yeah, I had to go to Belgium or something like that, and they put me on a 2-week binge, like go around tasting beers. By the time I got on Big Brother, I was wankered. You know?
but they take everyone to different places.
Yeah, some of them were in Belgium. Some of them were in different areas of the country, and they like hid us from the other contestants that were around the town.
Yeah, yeah.
So they'd get calls saying, "Don't bring Pete to this part of Belgium because someone else is in that part of Belgium." So they had to keep us separate, so we didn't ever meet them or something like that. Do you know what I mean?
And did you get a choice of the country, or did they just go, "You're going to Belgium"?
No choice. I just go to Belgium. Yeah, yeah. I didn't have a great time because
Belgium's lovely. Whereabouts were you?
I don't know. I was stuck in some like I was stuck in farm like in with loads of chickens.
Right.
Yeah, and I had to play the chickens each day to keep me occupied and go around tasting beer, I suppose. Like that.
So basically, they hid you in a chicken farm.
Yeah, chicken farm. It was great. I made fun. I had fun with chickens. I didn't do anything naughty with them. I just,
and so what have you been doing since Big Brother then? I know you've written two books, which is...
No, actually, it's only one book, but the other one's like a soft copy,
right,
with a different picture on the front. One's called Pete My Story, the other one's called Pete My Journey with Tourette's.
Yeah.
And they're pretty much the same book, but the other one's looks a bit more a heartfelt story. The other one's just, you know, hardback.
Well, but it's the exact same book.
Exactly the same book, yeah.
Just a different title.
Yeah, same book, different title. One's softback, one's hardback.
Okay, right. And so it was mainly about your Tourette's then?
Actually, the beginning start is about Tourette's. So every time we talk about Tourette's, I start twitching. As soon as I say Tourette's, I go, sorry about it. But,
I won't say it again.
It's all right.
No, you've told me now. That's our buzzword.
People ask me, like, what's happened to your Tourette's? And I start going, wankers. And then sometimes they meet me and they say, why haven't you called me a wanker? And they get offended. So I need to call them a wanker just to keep them happy.
So you keep call everyone a wanker and everyone's happy then?
Because people expect me to have the same velocity of Tourette's as I did when I was younger on Big Brother, but now I'm 31, it's calmed down. And because you do slow down when you're older, so people expect me to call them a name when I see them.
I didn't know that, though. What, Tourette's gets...
Yeah, the doctors said that it would calm down with age when I was younger.
I had no idea, and
I didn't believe them because I was the worst ever case recorded in Europe. I had like 50 out of 55 known twitches. So that was pretty... I was the best Tourette in the whole world. Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thanks very much. But now I'm not. I'm last place now.
But you got... you actually got it when you were 14, or did you always have it?
No, I had it when I was 5. I was sniffed and stuff.
Right.
sorry. And then I used to wiggle my head a lot. My nose would go quite a lot and that. And I had a funny breathing twitch and all that. And... it got worse when I went to school because, you know, kids aren't very nice, are they? You know,
they're
what are you twitching for? And I didn't know what was wrong with me.
Right.
So I used to make up little excuses about what was going on and that. But I wasn't diagnosed until someone got bullied too much and I had to go to hospital because some geezer stuck a rubber up my nose and I had to go get it checked out in hospital. And then...
How far up did the rubber go?
Well, I can't remember. It didn't come back out. I think it's still in there? I think it's still stuck up there. I think it's rubbed out a part of my brain because I'm absolutely completely bonkers now. I haven't got any idea what's going on.
But so are people... because of Big Brother, are people very friendly towards you?
Yeah, they are actually. I was a very lucky one who came out and I still get lots of... Everyone still recognises me and takes a picture and goes mental. Right. So that's pretty cool, you know?
But you like that then, yeah?
Well, it's better than being chased down the road with daggers and fire sticks, do you know what I mean?
Was that happening as well, yeah?
Yeah. No, that hasn't happened yet. I mean, it might happen one day. bit to think that would happen. Hopefully not. You know what I mean?
And so, what are you mainly up to these days then?
Well, I'm an actor now. Well, it was a dream job that came true, but it hasn't really. You know, it started. I started on horror films. I thought to myself, "Well, I really want to be in a zombie film." That was a couple of years ago. And I kind of went, yes, I'm going to get one. You know, when you kind of do that that chanting, yeah, I'm going to get in a film. And then suddenly it pops up and says...
What, like a Buddhist chant?
Well, no, more like, dear God, please may I have a nice film with zombies in it. And then on Twitter, this director called Warren Speed just said, all right, mate, do you want to be in my film? And it was called Zombie Women of Satan 2. And I was like, oh, yeah, all right, then. Yeah, go on then. You know what I mean? So that was my chance to get into a proper film. And I had a main part called Bertie Dumble, and I was this geezer who was like, oh, hello there, darling, how are you? And I infected these birds with, like, zombie power, and they go and chase Pervo the Clown and kill him. Oh, it's a daft film, but...
Yeah, there's a lot going on. I'm not quite following it.
I don't know what's going on through the film, but I think it was definitely, I went there, they loved me, and they said, oh, wait, Pete, you're wicked. So they got me in more films now.
And brilliant.
Yeah, that was it was a good place to practice. And then I went on to do another film called The White Room. That's a short film, and I'm like a homicidal clown because I've got a really evil laugh. Do you want to hear it?
Yeah, of course I do.
So anyway, that's pretty scary. Do you know what I mean? So, sorry, I'm chatting so much.
That's what you're here for.
But oh, right, that's right, isn't it, eh? So, let's give you a chance. So how's it been since the Thai food advert, then?
It's been rough since the Thai food.
I woke up this morning feeling fine. Right. Sorry, that's what it's like if people say, hey, it's Pete from Big Brother. And if people keep reminding you.
But the experience itself, because like, you're saying that you don't really like what's become of Big Brother now.
Oh, how do you know that?
It's written down.
But yeah, I wasn't so keen. I'm not so keen on it now. I mean, yeah, it didn't. It went real downhill, I think, afterwards, and it's gone a bit. It went all that race row, and then another one, and then I never really recovered, I think. And then now it's not like they don't really put people who have much to. I don't know. I find it just to be like a. It's just like a sausage market now, isn't it? I mean, like, you know.
Well, it is what it is, isn't it?
Well, I know, but, yeah, I don't know, I just,
Did you not enjoy the last one, the celebrity one?
I don't watch it anymore.
Oh, come on.
No, I can't, man, I just can't, it reminds me, I've moved on from it.
Of course you have,
on from Big Brother, and I want to get on with my life, and I wish it had ended, to be honest, because I still just want to, oh, I don't know, man, I just... I did it. You know, when the ultimate Big Brother came out, you know, yeah. I wasn't on it, and I was like, well, pissed off. But
why weren't you on that?
I don't know, you know, because I don't know really. Maybe because I would have won, you know. Maybe.
But did they get in touch and say that you're not on it, or did they?
No, they got in touch and said, all right, Pete, do you want to be on the ultimate Big Brother? And I was like, oh, yes, please. And then they rang me up, got me down to the place to get. What's it called again?
Belgium.
Not Belgium. No. The psychiatrist to test your brain and see if you're allowed to get on it again. Anyway, I passed that, and then they.
So now tell us how stringent is that?
What?
How stringent is that test? Then?
They just sit there. Skeezer sits there and he just asks you all these questions about yourself. Just to make sure you're not a suicidal maniac or something like that. I don't know. My phone. Hello. And then I passed that. And yeah, and then they sent me a contract and said, oh yeah, it's £10,000, how about this? And I was like, oh yeah, great. So I was, I really wanted something to good happen. I really needed that lift because I was like, oh my God, you know, my best friend just died of cancer, right? And I was really, really gutted. I was like, worst things ever happened in my life, you know what I mean?
I'm sorry to
hear that. So when that happened, when I was the ultimate Big Brother came up, I was like, oh, you know, this is going to lift my spirits a lot because I was in a real dark hole. So when I thought I was going to get on it again, I was like, you know.
Well, it sounds like it.
Oh yeah, I was tragic, you know. But then the week before, I thought I was going to go on because the contract was there, signed it, rah rah. Like, I get a call saying, "Hello, Pete, it's Big Brother," and I was like, "Oh, hello, wicked," you know what I mean? Got excited, and then he said, "No, you're not getting on, sorry, Pete." And I was like, and then I just, you know, what? Oh my God, I mean, I was really, you know, it made me go even lower than I was already.
But like, they didn't explain; they just said you're not on it.
Yeah, they didn't ask me why. I just said, you know, why's that then? And they said, oh, I don't know. I just said. I don't know, it was really weird. And then when I watched the people go on, I was like, okay. It seemed like it was a little bit for Brian Downing show, you know, it wasn't.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, it's a shame, really, because... And then when I got stuck on there, I was in there for an hour as this boss, you know what I mean, just in a room, and I was a bit angry with it. I just thought, because it kind of, yeah, it got my spirits really high, and then suddenly just dropped me, so... And then, I don't know.
Things have been going well since then, though. Yeah?
Well, it's not. It's a struggle, you know. It's a struggle being me because I'm Pete from. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but also, like, you do music as well, though, don't you?
Well, I did have a band, right? And, I was. It was called Pete Bennett and the Love Dogs, and I was gigging a lot, and I got signed by EMI. Until I went and did a gig in front of them, and I said, this next song's called Superhero. Woo! If I had a superpower, I'd have an elasticated cock. Woo! And then I got dropped.
Before you got to the chorus.
It was a corporate gig, and I'm a punk band, and they thought I was a hot wire, and I got dropped straight away. So, but you know, whatever. Then I told the Sex Pistols, said, "Oh mate, can you believe EMI? Like, they dropped me anyway. Oh, they wouldn't see talent if it hit him in the face." So you know, they're on my side because they like my stuff.
Cool.
Yeah, they put me on their website saying, this is Pete Bennett, one of our favourite artists.
Lovely.
Yeah, so I was chuffed by that. That's good, isn't it?
but you're not doing music anymore then?
Well, the songs that I had, I'm getting them re-recorded with my mate Nelly at the moment.
Right. Nelly sounds like a proper American producer.
No, he's a geezer. He's English. He's British, right. And he loves music. And we're making it sound really punky and really British punk, like proper Sex Pistols-y stuff. And that's in the pipeline to be released soon. I just need to get some nice music video to go with it, though. Do you know what I mean?
Do you need a video anymore?
Well, that's what it's like nowadays, isn't it? It's YouTube. That's how it all kicks off. You need a wicked video. And then it just gets like, you know, shared around, and then like you know, De Antwoord, you know that rap band, you know, with their little
48.
Well, they had a wicked video and it kicked off, and then now they're superstars. You know, it's all about the video. It's got to be that. You know what I mean?
Right. So, are you going to make the video yourself then?
Well, I've got a boom new camera now, and I'll be taking a picture of you later, but not in the nude. But
is it a stills camera?
Yeah, stills and video.
Right, yeah, because I'm just saying you probably need more than a stills camera for your video.
Yeah, no, it's going to be a proper camera. Like, because I got it by applying for a grant for the Tourette Syndrome Association. I said I got told by that Brent Zilwood off of the Undateables. He's got a new camera. I said, how'd you get that? He goes, you've got to just apply for a grant for the Tourette's Association. I was like, yes, please. So I just said, I've got Tourette's, so I need it. It's really, please. And they gave me one. Well, $2, because I gave him 400,000 grand, you know what I mean? So yes, please. Thank you very much, Tourette's Syndrome Association. It was very lovely of you.
No, that was very sweet of you. Gave him all that money, though.
Well, I needed to help him out. Well, I'm supposed to be the Tourette's hero, you know what I mean? That's why I did Big Brother in the first place.
Right.
To be this, to inject Tourette's into the vein of the country, because there wasn't really any positive Tourette's awareness going around, was there? It was just like this.
Well, no, I think with Tourette's people, like, I think some people might feel uncomfortable, but nobody kind of has a bad word to say about people. You know, with Tourette's.
Well, they do. That's the thing. I had lots of bad words said about me before the show. Oh, mate, just like, I used to get like the piss taken out of me. If I was sitting in a pub before my brother, I'd be twitching away. And, you know, you'd get people imitating me and not understanding and having the right laugh. And, you know, maybe.
Yeah.
And when I'd walk down the street and I'd go, wankers, without even noticing, you know, I'd get tapped on the shoulder and some big geeks are going, what you call me? And I was like, what do you mean? And then I said, I've got Tourette's. And especially this time I was in a pub, this chav walked through the door. And I went, quakers, as soon as he walked through the door. But that was real. I actually meant to do that.
Sometimes do you do it? No,
that was a joke. But when I was younger in school, I would put the fake one out for the teachers. Because that's the fun of having Tourette's when you're young. You could have a good old laugh with it, you know what I mean?
But it is that thing of, like, I didn't really think too much about you getting into trouble. Like, obviously people thinking you're calling them names.
Yeah, of course. That was why I needed to go on Big Brother, because I needed to sort my life out. Because I couldn't walk down the street, because I had really bad... The wanker's twitch was so bad, I just couldn't live properly. And so I sorted myself out after Big Brother, and I sorted out loads of other people who had Tourette's. Now they're understood and they can accept themselves. And I've had lots of praise from young people and mums and dads and all that.
Well, listen, Pete, thanks so much for coming in. And it's nice to see you, because I'm sure it's a daily struggle for you, isn't it?
Not anymore. That's the thing. It's fine. I'm happy. I walk down the street going, not all those funny noises.
Well, we all do that.
But, maybe you've got Tourette's, mate. What am I saying? That's all right. I don't mind coming in. It's great. Thanks for having me. Am I finished then, am I?
but we play a tune for you, if you like. Right. Who do you, I'll give you the choice. Blur, Julian Cope, or the Tindersticks?
What? Who are that? Oh, no, I only know Blur. Who's Julian Kerr?
Julian Cope. We'll play Julian Cope for you then, okay? Thanks so much for coming in, Pete.
I'm going to go up to North and film a film called Coulrophobia, our next Spinal Tap sort of film. So look out for that too. Woohoo!
Right.
Sorry, there's a plug there.
Absolutely.
A blatant.
Say it again.
Coulrophobia coming your way soon.
Cheers, Pete. Thanks very
nice
much.
Nice one.
Radio the finger.
Beautiful freak, beautiful freak.
catch your flying inside. Dart down and then go for cover. And know that I love you. Beautiful freak, beautiful freak. You know that I love you. Beautiful freak, beautiful freak. Beautiful freak, beautiful freak. Beautiful freak, beautiful freak.
That's Eels, Beautiful Freak. And now another guest. Wow, it's just guest. Nish Kumar, who's a great comic. I saw him only a while back. And how long have you been doing the comedy now?
About 6 years, I think, now.
You're a novice. So like a baby.
I love it. It depends where you are. The context completely changes what status I am as a... Because gig to gig, like, you go to gigs with people who've been doing it 20 years, and they're like, oh, you're a baby. And then you go to another gig, and everyone's like, I've been going 5 months.
I know.
I suddenly turn into the gnarled veteran.
But what age are you, though?
I'm 28.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you pretty much always wanted to be a comic then, yeah?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think I would never have... I didn't really know how you became a comedian, I think, for a long time. I think in my head, I was just like, I think of myself as a comedian, and therefore I am one.
You were in university, yeah?
Yeah, I was at Durham, and we did, and there was an opportunity to join a sketch.
Oh, you poor thing. Durham? Like, it's a lovely place to go for the day.
Yeah.
But how many years were you there?
I was there 3 years.
Get this man some whiskey! And so what were you studying?
English and history.
Right. Was it one of those where, like, you had to do maybe 2 lessons a week?
Yeah, man, 6 hours of contact time a week. That's what they called it.
And then the rest of the time you're in Durham.
The rest of the time I was in... But I, like, when we were at Durham, there were people who were kind of seriously into clubbing, and they would sort of say, well, there's nothing for me to do here. I hated nightclubs.
Yeah.
So I could stand there pretending, being like, oh, yeah, it really sucks, there are more clubs in the town. So it's full of old man pubs. You can sit and have a nice drink and a chat. It was perfect for me.
It's got that lovely cathedral. But
yeah,
as I say, everything you said, you can do in an afternoon.
Yeah,
you were there
right.
For 3 years. 3 years. Oh, I feel so much better about myself. When I think of myself, you know, watching Neighbours going, there's 20 minutes and never getting back, I'm just going to always think, Nish was in Durham for 3 years.
I'd love to say it forces you to be more creative, but I think it made me sleep more.
Well, yeah, I guess so. Well, of course, yeah. But so then did you ever get a job or did you start working?
Well, yeah, I graduated and I did 2 years of sketch comedy and we got to go to Edinburgh and I had this amazing time.
So what, you never
friends.
Did a proper job? You went straight into comedy?
No, and then I graduated and lost my nerve and I had, like, I was a headhunter in the financial sector of the city for about 6 months.
See, I love finding out what comics used to do.
Oh,
so.
Man, and I sucked so badly.
But so you were the headhunter?
Yeah.
So you went to find other people?
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But
that's quite a big job.
I was so bad at it because the whole point is because, like, a recruitment person is somebody who takes people out of work and finds them jobs. Headhunter is somebody who finds people in a job and then puts them in a better job. But I never understood the motivation for doing that. So I'd call people up and they'd be like, yeah, I'm earning £100,000 a year. And I'd be like, that sounds great. Carry on with that. Persist with your job.
But I don't understand that. So, like, where was your skills for that? Like,
there's absolutely no skills. They will hire you as long as you can speak in coherent sentences and you have done a degree from whatever blue chip university.
I've been in Durham for 3 years?
I was like,
give
guys,
me a break.
Yeah.
Yeah, let him be the headhunter. So you're just randomly ringing up people and going, do you want a job?
Yeah, honestly, it was like that. And you'd have to do weird things like, because you weren't supposed to be calling these people. People who work on the receptions at big companies are trained to spot headhunters. So I would like do accents and stuff. You had to deliberately disguise yourself.
You would have been known as the headhunter then?
Yeah, so I'd have to pretend to be from another. It's hugely deceitful.
Right.
And some of it is almost certainly apparently illegal as well.
So you'll ring up a company and just go, can I speak to Mr. Tim?
Yeah, and I'm from, and you'd make up some fake bank company and I'd speak in like a really bad American accent.
Go on,
and
give
hope
us
that
a...
they didn't. I'd be like, hey, my name's Chad Kroger and I'm from the MoneyCorp banking system. Can I please speak to whoever is your most important person?
Who's best there? Who's best there at your job? Can I put them on?
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And so, but so you said you lost your nerve after doing some sketch comedy.
Yeah, I lost my, because I did 2 years. We got to go to Edinburgh. I'd never been to Edinburgh before. It was mind blowing because I've always been a comedy fan when I was a kid. And I got.
So, who did you like when you were a kid?
I started watching things like old Woody Allen movies and Richard Pryor, and I started watching The Simpsons when I was about 6 years old.
You know they're not real.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I tell you, that was an eye-opener. That's one of the things I found out when I was in Durham, you know? You have had a bit of extra reading time on my hands. But, like, it was always in my head, those kind of comics, and stand-ups particularly, I saw Chris Rock when I was a kid,
right.
And those kind of American stand-ups seem to be the most exciting people in the world.
And so, like, because a lot of your shows you talk about being an Asian as
yeah.
well, yeah? Because, like, there still isn't that many Asian comics, though, is there?
No, there's not that many, and I can tell you exactly how many are because it depends on who I'm confused.
Because you've headhunted them.
Yeah, because I've got a list of on the top of my wall, Paul Chowdhury, Ramesh Ranganathan, Ahir Shah, and this is my hit list for the next sort of 5 to 6 months.
But is that weird? Like, is there a bond there between you guys? Or
yeah,
no?
I mean, I think there is. I don't know Paul Chowdhury particularly well, but I guess if we met, we'd have some stuff to talk about.
Well, he only ever says hello white people, isn't he?
Yeah, that's right. He's only interested in knowing what's going on with white people.
Yeah. So, but, yeah, talk to me.
Yeah, he'd have a chat with you.
But I
started at a similar time as Ramesh and Ahir, and they're right. kind of friends of mine. So we, you know, we kind of come up together. So I know those two pretty well.
Well, no, that's great, though. Because it is weird, like the people you come up with, you kind of tend to remain friends with them.
Is it like, I'm assuming it's like this for every generation. It feels like a school year. Like you start
Very
with the
much,
same
yeah.
group of people and it's like these are the same people that you came up with, and sometimes you meet people, and even if they're like Josie Long is somebody who I'm very friendly with, good friends with, and she's not particularly dissimilar age to me, but whenever I see her I'm like, oh, she's in the year above.
Really,
don't say
yeah.
anything stupid. Yeah.
Well, of course, we were all the first ones doing it,
yeah.
so
so
we were there. So kick. We used to, that's the weird thing, because I never really liked the clubs, but I think there was a lot more camaraderie when we were starting it.
Right.
Every
okay.
time I do a club now, and I know it's people, you know, making a living, so they're going, yeah, I'm going off to do another 8 gigs.
Yeah.
But we used to like hang out and watch people and stuff. That doesn't seem to happen anymore.
I feel like it does happen. I mean, I hate to stay and hang around with. Maybe it's just me. Maybe
yeah.
I'm just the over-keen one. Hey, guys, I'm going to watch everybody. I'm having a great evening. No, I feel like there is. And I think there's a sort of camaraderie that gets brought out most in Edinburgh, where,
yeah.
you know, when
you
you're
mean
all
drinking.
There together. For, yeah, drinking,
yeah.
that's what I mean, yeah.
But, so, are you mainly doing clubs now, or are you doing little tours?
I'm mainly doing clubs and then kind of Soho runs of
right.
my previous shows. So I've done a couple of runs of both of my solo shows in the Soho, and then doing the odd performance. I'm going to Melbourne for the first time in a month's time to do my show again.
Have a great time, yeah.
Really looking forward to it.
So the new show, what's that one about?
Well, this show that I've been taking in Melbourne, and I think I'm doing one more at the McCuntleth Festival. The McCuntleth Festival.
What's that?
It's a small comedy festival in Wales that is the most fun I have in my calendar
year. I've
never
even heard of it.
It's wonderful. It's really, really fun. It's just a tiny town in Wales, and they kind of take it over and put on comedy there. And that's the last performance I'll do of that show. It's called Nish Kumar is a Comedian, and it's the one I did in Edinburgh and at the Soho Theatre in December.
And why is it called that?
It's called that for a couple of reasons. My first show was called Who is Nish Kumar? So I like the idea of a
okay.
question and answer.
And your name.
And my name. And also, it's because the whole premise of the show was my poster for my 2012 show got turned into an internet meme.
Yeah, so explain what happened.
Well, I got contacted. A friend of mine found this on a meme website. I didn't even know what these things were. And it's where they take photos that people find on the internet and put captions on them according to a theme. So there's like the surprised man, which is a photo of a guy looking bemused in a festival crowd. Everybody puts loads of different reasons on it. And there's lots of different varieties of these. And somehow, my photo got used by an internet meme, and the meme was called The Confused Muslim.
Right.
And so there'd be loads of like hypothetical philosophical problems for a Muslim written all over my face.
That was freaky.
It was so weird. I opened the email, it was my friend Jack Barry sent it to me, and I opened it, and I just couldn't understand what was going on.
Yeah.
And they didn't seek permission for it. There's no way of me knowing who made it originally. The reason that they found the picture is because a review of my previous show had quoted me saying that I'm confused with being both a Jew and a Muslim, because I got one of those faces that people seem to struggle to place the ethnicity of it. And so that had been reprinted verbatim. So now when you Google the phrase confused Muslim, picture of it. Yeah.
Because you're not a Muslim, are
you? No, well, I'm from a Hindu family.
Right.
So it's...
And are you religious in that sense?
I would struggle to say no to that question.
But Hindus just seem to be the nicest religion.
It's a nice religion. You can't... it depends which school of Hinduism you come from, but for the school of Hinduism my family practices, you're technically not allowed to convert people. So because of that, it means there's no proselytising. And so it's just, it's just a basic thing of going, you should be nice to people, and that's really the end of it.
Yeah, but
you
believe in everyone's God as well.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
See, that's like... But isn't it the main kind of character is the elephant creature, is it?
That's one of the... Matt, there are many hundreds upon thousands of gods.
I must tell you, I was in a craft shop, in Belgium, and I just looked at the thing and said, oh, that's a lovely sculpture of an elephant. And this guy went, that's our God. I went, I'll leave you.
I will take that sculpture, yes.
Listen, we'll play a tune and then we'll ask you more about your new show. The Smiths, we haven't played them yet. Here goes, Big Man Strikes Again. There's the Smiths there. I think, I was just saying to Nish, I think he might have run out of lyrics there, because the last minute of that, he does a lot of ha-ha-ha.
There's a lot of padding. Morrissey was padding.
Yeah, there's no way he wrote that down, says that, and now I'm going to say ha-ha-ha-ha.
I don't know. I've read some of Morrissey's autobiography. It's very possible he wrote down ha-ha-ha-ha. The man has
Did you enjoy it?
I couldn't get into it. I really couldn't. I love Morrissey, I love the Smiths, and I just couldn't. I really just couldn't get into it.
So besides your prison sentence in Durham, are you London-based always?
Yeah.
So just brought up in London?
Yeah, I grew up in Croydon.
Well, that's not London.
Well, it's certainly not Surrey.
Well, no, it's Croydon. We've established that fact. But and so you're a Palace fan then?
No, not
get
really.
Get out! What is wrong with you? You have to support your local team. Nish Kumar, what team do you support?
Manchester United.
Oh, come on. This is just going from bad to worse.
I was raised in South London. It's traditional for me to support Manchester United.
You have to start supporting Palace. That's the only way. So your new show in Edinburgh. So have you started doing that yet?
Yeah, I've started doing the first sort of inklings of what the new show
and
is
going
to be.
What's it called?
Well, I don't know yet. We're still sort
let's
of toying with the
now.
Titles.
Right. What's the show about?
Well, one of the things I want to talk about is
evil Durham town.
Yeah, so that's what. I got a couple of people. It was only after leaving university that I ever heard of that song.
It's not a great song.
It's not a great song.
But you know, there you go.
I'm interested in talking about subjectivity this year.
Right.
Like, I'm interested in the idea that I'm starting my sets at the moment by assuring people that it's fine that they not enjoy what I'm doing.
Right.
Because
okay.
I think I'm interested.
No titles springing to mind, yeah.
Yeah. I'm interested in the idea that people proffer opinions, and this is a culture of opinions.
Yeah.
But nobody ever seems to feel the need to justify their opinions. Nobody ever seems to feel like with Twitter and comments, you can just leave your opinion and it's enough that you've opined and that is the end of your interaction with something.
My favourite people in life are the ones that when you ask them, they go, I've no opinion on that.
Yeah.
Rather than going, well, I'm just going to say some nonsense just so I can say things. But my big beef, and I think a lot of my next show is going to be about, is used language. And people use cliche.
Yeah.
And they say they're their feelings. And I go, no, that's someone else's thoughts.
Yeah.
And you should have your own.
Yeah. I mean, if you watch any post-match interview with any footballer.
But no, because I use an example even now on stage where I hate when you hear guys, when they say they're in love, and says that every time she goes and walks into the room, it's like there's butterflies in my stomach.
Yeah.
I'm going, but no, that makes no sense. It's actually your balls are tingling. And just say that. That's enough. We'll know. Don't romanticise it with nonsense.
I mean, it is astonishing that people feel the need to dress it up more than that.
Life is great.
Yeah.
You know, you don't need to pretend there's butterflies in your stomach. I do the add-on that I say with the tingling in the balls. So if a butterfly comes into the room and lands on your balls, mention that.
Yeah.
That's a very special moment.
Yeah, but, that's an incredible.
Yeah, that's, wow, butterflies land on my balls.
That's the nice crossover between the obscene and the sublime.
Yeah,
that's
what I'm going for. But so you still haven't really sold me with the show.
Okay.
So I want you to do that. So then we can get a title for you.
Okay, that's right. Well, so at the moment, there's a lot of chat about subjectivity. There's about 5 minutes about why I don't like the Big Bang Theory. There's a bunch of stuff. There's more race stuff about some of it's off the back of me finding a survey saying that a percentage of people in this country, 34% of people who responded to a YouGov poll, said that they would be uncomfortable with the idea of a non-white prime minister. So when
really?
Yeah.
But also, this is another beef of mine. You say that, and then it's out there as fact.
It's gospel.
Yeah, but that's the thing. Like, you can make up statistics all the time.
That is the problem. But yeah. When I saw this poll, I looked at the poll data, and I have all of the full YouGov document. And when I read, it's bad. I mean, you might relate to this after a while. It's bad when you read something and your first thought is, oh, that's incredibly interesting. And your second thought is, I can get 5 minutes minimum out of this for my next Edinburgh show.
But yeah, because you do deal with race in a lot of your shows, though, don't you?
Yeah. It's weird. I think I didn't really think that it would be play such a prevalent part because actually being an Asian in Britain in 2014... It's pretty easy. It's pretty easy in terms of race relations. But for some reason, it's a kind of recurring obsession of mine. So some of it is that it is way easier to be non-white.
But so you don't come across much racism yourself, then?
The weird thing is, I have on two separate kind of moves that I made. Because I grew up in Croydon. It's a very multicultural place. You spend a lot of time in London.
It's near London, folks, if you want to know where Croydon is.
Croydon is in London, Sean.
It's near London.
Croydon is in London. Croydon is a part of London. It is a London. This is the funny thing about Croydon, is it's both a London borough and in Surrey, and yet is wanted by neither.
Right.
It's
twinned with Durham. But also, like, just from the way you look, have you been to America? Yeah.
No. Well, I went when I was a kid, but no, I've not really been.
Because I'm just wondering, you do look a bit like a terrorist.
Yeah.
You know.
No, getting away from it.
Do you get stopped?
I used to get stopped at airports quite a lot. I mean, my dad travels for his job quite a lot, and he travelled on the 12th of September 2001. So literally, they've started, and he flew to New York, and we all said this is madness. And he was like, well, no, it's the safest time to fly. I mean, there's going to be more security than any other point. But the problem is he was thinking about protection from the terrorists rather than from Homeland Security. And, like, his bag got ransacked and stuff. And then he was telling us, surprised afterwards, well, of course, I think you look like a terrorist. I'm not 100%
sure. So do you look like your dad then?
Yeah, kind of, yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah, I think I've got one of those faces that's exactly 50% of both my parents.
Wow, that's a bit creepy.
It's really strange. It's really odd. Sure.
Family dinners must be very odd.
Most people lead one way or the other. Yeah. My face is a happy compromise between the two.
Were they brought up in England or did they come over?
They met in England. My mum grew up in Kenya, and then she moved here. She moved to Leicester when she was about 16. And my dad was in Kerala really until he was about 20, about
Sorry,
my
where?
Age, 28. Kerala on the south coast of India. It's a tiny, tiny little state right on the south coast.
But so, without me harping into a cliche, but they must have been expecting you to be a comedian, though.
No, God, no.
How are they about that?
Well, the arc of my parents' relationship with my job has been part of the bedrock of my two stand-up shows as well. Because they've come around to the idea. I think initially they were genuinely perplexed because I mean this is me now reciting elements of my act from the first show, but the stereotype of corner shops and then kids become doctors is a that's a standard immigrant model. The parents come over, they do whatever job that they can get, and the idea is that you then educate your kids so much that they can become a part of the machinery of the state. Because
but
then
you've got your headhunting to go back on.
I've got my headhunting to fall back on. Telling them. This is what I keep... I mean, I was awful at it. But yeah, it blew them away. My mum's is still like... My dad says if you didn't bear such a strong resemblance to me and your mother, we'd assume you were someone else's kid.
That's charming. So dinner at yours is weird arguments and you looking like half you looks like the other one. Great stuff. But when do you start doing again, we still haven't got a title yet.
No, we still haven't got a title.
You've got
a little
bit of Race, a little bit of Big Bang Theory.
A little bit of How Much I Hate the Big Bang Theory,
Right. And why do you hate the Big Bang Theory?
I hate it so much.
Do you think it didn't happen?
No, I'm talking about the television show.
There's me being all highbrow.
You need to lower your size, Sean. Okay. I'm talking about the sitcom The Big Bang Theory. I think I hate the Big Bang Theory so much because I think it's a not particularly good programme that, for some reason, people who have good-tasted comedy think is a brilliant comedy programme.
Why don't you call it Nishikumar Hates the Big Bang Theory?
Yeah, I might call it that. I think that would certainly get people in.
Well, yeah, there you go. And listen, but it's an absolute pleasure. So where can people see you? Like, obviously, you're off to Melbourne, which you'll have a great time.
Good. I'm looking forward to it. So have you been before?
Yeah, the first time you go is amazing.
Great.
I would say... Take a tranquilizer on the plane.
Right, it's a long journey.
It's a very long journey. Unless Liam Neeson's on the plane being a marshal, then you'll be all right. But listen, it's been absolute joy. I'm going to play Blur for you because obviously you're a Londoner and you probably like them.
Thanks, Fabulous.
because you're young. She's a gun. Now what you done? Be the bum. She'll suck you bum. She'll make you come. 'Cause she's your gun.
There's Blur there, Beetle Bum. I think that's about drugs. I've got my best new friend in here now, Orlando Seale. Do you know what that song's about?
I think you're right. I don't dare say something terrifying.
But it is. I think it's about heroin. But you know what when you have to be told, because it doesn't come across in any of the lyrics.
Perhaps that's intentional. Perhaps they're being, you know, it's just that altered state, that craziness.
Well, I don't even know what Beetle Bum is. But anyway, Orlando, you're coming in to sing a couple of tunes.
Yeah.
But you kind of freaked me out by saying we met in Cyprus.
Yeah, we did. We met at the one most incongruous place. I was somehow roped into introducing people presenting at this Cyprus rally thing. And I don't know anything about cars. I was the last person in the world that should have been doing this, but I was a host in front of millions of people.
But how did you get this job, though?
I don't know.
Because you've always been a musician, haven't you?
Yeah, I've been a musician and an actor. I'm an actor as well.
See, I didn't know that.
Oh, there you go.
Right.
Yeah. See, I do lots of that stuff. I've just been in Toronto, actually, last week, doing a flirtatious Scotsman on a show called Rain, which is really fun.
Okay, but have you been to Durham?
I have not played in Durham.
Yeah, well, there you go. You're missing
there
out.
There you go.
Well, so it's kind of... Because I was reading your blog as well, and for some reason you managed to get Elliot Smith's...
Oh, yeah. Well, what was an amazingly lucky thing, which was that I was dating a lovely woman in Los Angeles who...
I happen
to travel. It's that actor's life. And I was there and I met this wonderful woman who happened to seem to know every one of my idols. She sort of dated Jeff Buckley and was friends with Elliot Smith.
She sounds like a bit of a jinx.
She was kind of ridiculous. Robert Plant wrote a song about her called Wonderful One.
Right.
And and Eve from the Eels and Nigel Godrich and all my heroes. Anyway, so she had this beautiful old Guild guitar, and apparently Elliot Smith would borrow it for his recordings, and that was the first guitar that I picked
up. And was he a big influence on you, Elliot Smith?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you wouldn't, I guess, know that at all from what my songs sound like, but he's
we'll be the judge of
that. You can decide. You can get a little trace of this. But yeah, he was, because he was just, I suppose when I got there, the thing is, as you know, LA is enormous and you have to drive everywhere, and so I just got a chance to really listen to music in a way that I hadn't done since I'd been at university, where you just suddenly, you know, you put on an album and you're just totally immersed in it.
So did you go to acting?
I went to university, to Oxford. I did English and French, did a lot of acting there. And then I went to drama school in Paris at the Conservatoire.
Is that for mime?
Well, no, it isn't for mime, but I did study that, and I studied clown and I studied a bunch of different things. I've been around. I'm a vampire. I'm millions of years old. I'm at least 500 years old.
Okay.
And I've been a man and a woman. I've been all sorts of different things, and a giraffe, and
But so what would you consider yourself first and foremost then?
Well, I think, I mean, I just, God, I mean,
how besides
you,
obviously
how
destroying the planet with all your travel.
Exactly, I know. I'm trying to do just, and all my road, you know, what motor racing, of course. No, I guess I think, to me, that acting and music are completely different. One is, you know, I really love acting, and it's working for somebody else, serving somebody else's project, and the music is my own project. So I suppose they're not really competing. They're just totally different. They sort of, for me, they fulfill very different things.
Yeah, but so you've got equal passion for both.
Well, I suppose I don't go home at night and just, hey,
yes,
I'll just do a bit of acting.
Every night.
Every night, I do. But what I mean is, I don't go back to my living room and think, I'll just do a monologue for myself.
Yeah.
Whereas I do, of course, with my guitar. So I suppose, I do play music probably more than I'm
well,
acting.
Also because, you know, the thing is, you're relying on other people for the acting work.
That's right. It's a perfect thing. It was when I was living in LA and auditioning for these shows and just thought, God, I could actually make your own little thing, which is a song, and it's only 3 minutes long. It's a perfect thing that you don't depend on anybody else to choose you for. You can just
And so
yourself.
Have you been doing many live shows?
Yeah, we do a lot. We've been playing a lot in the UK, and also a bit recently abroad in France and in Italy. And
how many passports have you got?
Well, you know, over the 500 years, I've managed to collect a few different ones.
The band is like a proper, like, folk orchestra, yeah?
Yeah, there's about 10 of us, and it fluctuates.
No, that's just not cost-effective.
And it isn't at all. I mean, very difficult touring. I had to enlist all the drivers from the Cyprus rally to get everybody around Europe. It was quite expensive.
But yes, good on you, because a lot of people would pare back in this economy.
Yeah.
You know, but you're going,
no maximalist. Totally.
So what are the instruments then?
Well, we've got two violas, cello, drums, percussion, harmonies, a woodwind, electric bass, electric guitar, all that stuff.
Well, sounds great.
And today, I only got one viola, but it's a very beautiful viola.
And a Becky. Guitar.
My guitar.
Yeah.
So it's just acoustic guitar and viola. But yeah, we often play in a very, very, very different. So in fact, for this, it's quite interesting. It's just thinking, okay, well, let's see, how can we play these songs just in a totally different way, you know?
Sorry, Orlando, are you saying you haven't practiced?
Oh, no, of course I've practiced a little bit. Yes, I have. Of course I have.
I don't think you're taking
the station
very seriously.
I'm taking it totally seriously.
You know what this is?
FUBAR Radio. Giving radio with a finger.
You know? So
oh, really?
Yeah, get your...
Yeah, well, I'm trying to get into the spirit of that. You know, I'm just trying to give it the finger. So, you know, that's why...
How long will it take you to set up now? Because I've got four choices of songs.
5 minutes, 2 minutes, 5 minutes, whatever you choose.
Tell me.
Yeah, 3-4 minutes.
Okay, well, I'll put on Tinder Sticks, which is 4 minutes. So you
perfect.
Can have a bit of breathing space.
Okay, thank you,
this
Sean.
This is bath time.
City feels at me, yeah. I love a man making it. Deep into the weave of the clothes I wear. And every step brings another. Every eye lets them on. Till I'm on the other side and on your door. Are the taps running dry? Is the air thick with steam?
Can I find some place to cry these tears of shame? And if a step brings another, every yard at some mall, till I'm on the other side, leaning on your door. There's a smell so sweet it's sickly, it follows me into the room, hangs in the air like rotting perfume. I never bit in a darling, got down on my hands and knees, got in so far I became a part of it all. I've been waiting through it, don't you know it's up to my name. And it won't be long, for it's over my head. And it's the thought of you in my mind that keeps me here. Thought I knew the streets and how they turn, could I was finding my way home. Something there, I can't leave it alone. The dreams they run all night, we could leave everything behind. Just bring that dress you wore when you first met. I know it's faded, darling, I know it's tattered and worn. In that dress I grew, never love you more. I've been waiting through it, don't you know it's up to my neck. And it won't be long, for it's over my head. And I can suck it into my blood, breathe it in.
Be them Tinder Sticks, Bath Time. Now, from one bit of string to some live strings, we actually have a viola in the house. And what's your name?
Becky.
Becky's on viola with the lovely Orlando Seal. So what song are you going to start off with?
We're going to play a song called Airplanes, which is on our...
Because you travel on them all the time.
That's right. I don't. Of course not. I go camel or rally drivers, like I told you.
Okay.
Depending on my...
So, and is there any... Like, does the song become very evident what it's about? Is it about drugs?
It's not about drugs.
Okay.
It's about... I'll just let you decide.
Okay.
Ambiguity's
all right,
good.
All right.
Yeah, you can tell me afterwards what you think the song's about.
Okay,
listen very carefully.
I will. Here it is. And it's called Airplanes.
It's called Airplanes.
Okay, this is the lovely Orlando Seal.
Fly away with a happy few. On the roof where the weeds come through. Who
There you go, Orlando. Say, what are you starting a fire for?
I'm really a bad person.
It was on main beds. Mother was telling them to disappear.
That's right.
There's too much going on there.
It's a very, very difficult life for some people.
I'm just saying, kids, don't start fires at home.
No. But that's only like to be done with guitars.
Yeah. And it sounded lovely. Thank you so much. As I say, I couldn't put my finger on exactly what it was about.
No, I know. But that's okay. Maybe that's intentional.
Yes, it could well be.
Ambiguity.
There's cornucopia. There was unmade beds. I was all trying to figure it all out, but I just haven't got the
what do you feel, Sean?
I felt like you're going to need a fire brigade nearby the gigs.
Yeah.
You 2 years at the end, you know, in harmony telling people to start a fire tonight.
Thank you.
What happens now if there's a fire in London tonight?
I'd feel so bad.
No, the police would be straight on to you.
It's like I was inciting people to a riot. I'm not.
And the next song now, what's the...
Okay,
what's
this is a little one, just as a contrast.
What's this called?
This is called Precipice.
See, I don't even know what that means.
Oh, yeah, I know. I've been throwing the dictionary at you. Cornucopias,
yeah,
precipice.
What's going on? Anyway, I'll let you get on with
it. I might need to put the mic a bit closer to this one, so I just put it like that.
Okay. Whatever suits you.
Okay.
just having a little supper walk now, Orlando. Bit of dead air there.
Sorry.
Tell me when you're ready.
I'm ready. Hang on a second.
Here we go.
Face to face in the dark, but I can't see your eyes. Who's gonna be the first to jump? Waiting for a sign. I thought I heard you breathing on the other end of the line. You don't know the consequences, no, do I? Little steps we took, we didn't realize. It's just a thought experiment that went to run. Doesn't matter how it happened or how it came to this. I don't know the story or who we are. Now I'm standing on the edge of a precipice. Now I'm standing on the edge of a precipice. Tie a knot to bind your wounded pride. Cover it with salt from swollen eyes. Neither you nor I will sleep tonight. Doesn't matter how it happened or how it came to this. I don't know the story or how. Now I'm standing on the edge of the precipice. Now I'm standing on the edge.
Right, so I was waiting for the I didn't think it was over there.
There you go.
Well, that was lovely.
See, that's the false ending.
A lot of sadness. A lot of sadness in the songs. Isn't there? A lot of sadness.
Oh, yeah, there is. I'm very sad.
So where can people see you? Because I know you've got a live album out as well.
Yeah, we're just finishing up mixing a live album, which we just recorded around Christmas time. And so
is it Christmas songs?
Actually, no. Funnily enough, no Christmas songs. Well, there's some songs about people who are quite drunk. So maybe they've been to a Christmas party.
Right.
So you could say that was a Christmas song.
Whatever. Yeah. I'll have that.
Song.
Yeah.
And we're just finishing that up, and then we'll be kind of setting up some gigs in the next few months, basically. And then we're going to be doing lots of festivals for the release.
Because it's Orlando Seal and the Swell.
That's right.
Yeah. Rather than just your
just
good
rather
self.
Than just Orlando Seal, which would be just me.
Well, listen, it's been adorable meeting you again.
And nice to meet you.
Thank you so
too,
much
again.
For coming in. I really appreciate it. And your good self.
Giving radio the finger.